Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 262, A Door into the Unconscious, with Jerry Trumbull. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
If you pursue this on the Google, you'll find that there are all kinds of people that I didn't know about who are proposing that you use the techniques that I'm about to discuss to gain, to fix yourself, to make yourself happier, to achieve new levels of motivation and so on and so forth. And most of these people want to sell you something. They want to sell you a course or some DVDs or CDs and so on. A couple of people have built careers behind this phenomenon, but it's free and it's available to everybody. So I'm going to blurt out how to do it, and then you can try it out yourself.
And of course, that was my old friend Jerry Trumbull, who clearly is no snake oil salesman, but rather is offering for free his own discoveries on opening the mind's eye. In this episode, Jerry and I have yet another one of our wide-ranging conversations, picking up the thread where we left off on Shrink Wrap Radio number 259. In the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned three inspiring documentaries for which you'll find links in the show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. The three films are I Am, Happy the Movie, and Genghis Blues. And I should mention that Genghis Blues is currently available on Netflix. Jerry Trumbull received his Bachelor of Science from the University of Maryland, his Master of Science from the University of Pennsylvania, and he's been a neuropsychological researcher at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research and NASA, and was also at the University of Maryland. He became an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and later became disgusted with academia, and he moved to Denver, where he founded Sebastian High School, a gradeless experiential learning center, founded the Western States Film Institute with two winners of the Student Academy Awards, and in 1980, founded Denver's first computer training center. Now retired and living in obscurity, he says, he's a videographer and blogger, where he expounds on local politics and pollution. He continues his lifelong interest in the workings of the human brain, exploring his own brain through hypnagogia and REM sleep, and hopes someday to upload the contents of his brain directly to the internet. Now, let's listen in on our conversation. Okay, friend Jerry, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back, Dave. How have you been?
I've been being good, actually. And,
good.
And I'm feeling really up and excited because I saw an amazing film last night, and there's a connection, synchronistic sort of connection to another amazing film. And in both cases, there's a good chance that I'm going to be interviewing the director of each of these two films, and I thought this would be of particular interest to you since you are a videographer and a filmmaker, so you've had your feet firmly planted in this world.
Yes, and I think it has a lot to do with dreams. Maybe we can talk about that later.
Yeah, I think it could tie in. But before I cut you loose on that topic, I wanted to share with you and with the listeners these two must-see films, one of which I've only seen myself so far. The one that I saw last night is called I Am, and you can find information about it on their website at www.iamthedoc.com. That's not as in I am the doctor, but more as in I am the documentary.
Right.
Yeah, so it's iamthedoc.com. Mm-hmm. The director's name is Tom Shadyac. So he's directed three or four films with Jim Carrey that were blockbusters. And in the process, it made him a millionaire, I think, many times over. And then he had an epiphany. He had a mountain biking accident in which he not only messed up his knee, but also got a concussion. And the concussion caused long-term psychological, emotional problems that really created a crisis in his life where he became fairly suicidal. But then that turned out to be the catalyst for a real turnaround in his life and to send him off on a project that he had been thinking about for some time, but it was a little too embarrassed to tell his friends and actually carry it out and bring it to the world. So basically what that project was this film that I saw last night, in which it's driven by two questions. What is the problem in the world? Generally, what is the problem with human beings and with what's going on in the world? And what is the fix? What's the solution? Those two basic questions. So he conducted interviews with such luminaries as David Suzuki, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lynn McTaggart, Ray Anderson, John Francis, Coleman Barks, and Mark Ian Barash. I wasn't familiar with each and every one of those people. The director I'm talking about, by the way, his name is Tom Shadyac, I think it is, Tom Shadyac. He was at the film last night, so I think that sort of adds to my excitement when the director is there and can address the audience and answer questions right after the film. It's just a very, very powerful film. And it definitely relates to what you and I have been talking about, because what emerges is, what's the problem? The problem is that we think we're separate. And there's all of this science of the sort that you and I have been talking about, and all of the spiritual wisdom that says, no, we're not separate. Everything is connected. As individuals, we're all connected, but we're also connected to the world of nature and to everything, to the whole picture. But we've built a society and a system. Western culture is built and driven on the notion that we are individuals, that we're separate individuals, and that we all need to compete with each other to get to the top. And that's how his life was driven, Tom Shadyac's, until he made this film. He sold off his mansions. He had a Beverly Hills mansion. I think he had more than one mansion. He sold off his private jet and scaled down his life considerably. So it's just a really, you know, exciting film, inspiring. And of course, I was gratified to see that two of the people that he interviewed in the film are people that I've interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio. One is Dean Radin, who I interviewed in Shrink Wrap Radio number 197 on scientific parapsychology. And he had some really good things to say in this film. And also Dacher Keltner, who I interviewed about positive psychology and who's really been one of the main influences on my thinking along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhat synchronistically, I had been contacted earlier by someone who asked if I would be interested in interviewing the director of a film that's about to come out called Happy. Now, by the way, you can find clips on YouTube, I think, of I Am. You can also find clips on YouTube of the film Happy. And it turns out that, she's putting me in touch with this director of the film Happy, who it turns out is the guy who directed the film Genghis Blues.
Aha, uh-huh, okay,
That's one of my favorite films. Did you ever see that one?
Yeah, I did. I think on your recommendation.
Yeah. It's about it's a blind blues singer in Oakland, California, who somehow on 78 RPM records discovered Tuvan throat singing somewhere near, outer Mongolia. Is this area where these people live. And listening to records, he learned to do this complicated kind of vocalization. And it's a wonderful story. He ends up going to that region of the world and competing in the contest with tube and throat singers, and right. and emerges as a champ.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting movie because there are so many disappointments in the journey.
Oh, that's a good point. There's setbacks.
Yeah, you're never sure that he's actually going to make it, you know. And then he gets sick, and there's all kinds of, as I recall, somebody's relative died, and it was just like, is this actually going to happen? And then, of course, it does happen, and he gets to sing, and actually that movie led to me looking into that Tuvan throat singing. There's quite a few clips on YouTube.
Oh, really? And people can do it. I've actually...
Yeah, you know, I tried it.
Well, I don't...
Unsuccessfully,
but... Yeah, I have no idea how to begin to try it. But I went to, as you know, a few years back, I went to a didgeridoo camp.
Yeah, same kind of sound, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there was a throat singing class there.
And
I didn't attend that class, and I sort of regret that I didn't do it. I think it would have been fun. And I since discovered that there's a fellow who teaches in the psych department part-time at Sonoma State who teaches on shamanism. And so as part of his whole immersion into the world of shamanic practices, he can do it.
Wow,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, so very, very interesting. So at any rate, that director's name I'm blocking on at the moment, but the guy who directed that film is directing this film called Happy, and somebody you know, contacted me and said, hey, would you be interested in interviewing him?
Yeah.
I said yes, and so that's all in process still.
Well, sounds like you're branching out into the world of film.
Yeah, or it's coming my way, which is exciting and wonderful. But to add synchronicity upon synchronicity, it turns out that the director of Genghis Blues and the forthcoming film Happy is an executive producer of the film I Am that I saw last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Small world.
Right. Really, really. So yeah. I just really wanted to let you know that you've got to put these two films on your to-do list and somehow see them.
Yeah.
I imagine eventually they'll be available. They're both going to be in general release.
Good.
But I don't know how widely circulated they'll get. So hopefully eventually they'll end up either on Netflix or people will be able to buy a reasonably priced copy. And that was something that Tom Shadyac committed to last night. He said that was going to happen.
Good. Excellent.
But he said before that, he had kind of a commitment to the theaters to do the theater circuit first.
Sure. Yeah.
And I should let people know that the next filming is going to be in Los Angeles. And I think from there, he said he's going to New York. So any listeners in those two cities should keep their eye out for the film I Am.
Well, as you know, my lifelong interest has been involving brain-to-brain communication. And often when I took up film, which is back in 1971, people said, well, that's totally different from what you were doing with your electrodes and animals' brains and stuff. And actually, I saw the connection was, there were a couple of connections. The main one was that the transfer of emotion from one human to another human being. When you're in a movie theater, you're staring at a blank screen. It's actually blank most of the time. And as you know, the pull-down mechanism shows one still at a time.
Right.
At a certain frame rate. And 16 millimeter was 24 frames per second. To our visual setup, it looks like motion. And some people can see a little flickering. And if you slow it down, of course, most people can see, what is that called? The flicker fusion rate or something.
Yeah, that's it.
And so I was thinking, okay, there's a whole bunch of people sitting in a dark room staring at a screen that's mostly blank. And then at certain points in that film, they all start crying. Almost, you know, all the people start getting tears in their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
So some, or they laugh, or they shout, or whatever. Their emotional response is engendered by this illusion. And in a sense, it's a direct communication between the brain of the filmmaker and the brain of the viewer.
Okay, let me cut in here because my head is exploding with reactions.
To
what you're saying. One is, it reminds me of Plato's metaphor of the cave, you know, where the people are sitting in darkness, they're seeing these shadows and they think that's reality.
Right.
And so it's really a directly, you know, parallel to that parable or whatever you would call it.
Yeah.
Because when we're looking at the, you know, if we didn't know it was a movie, we would think that we're looking at something real. Now, the other direction my head is exploding in is that whole topic was one of the central ones in the film I Am last night.
Ah.
And so they talked a lot about the heart and how the heart we think of the brain as the seat of all the important action, but it turns out that the heart and the vagal nervous system.
Right.
And I just got a book. I'm going to be interviewing, you might know this guy's name. His last name is Porges, I think, P-O-R-G-E-S.
Does that
ring a bell?
Well,
he's the guy who's done huge research on the vagal nervous system. I haven't even read the book yet, so I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. But evidently the heart, according to the film, radiates measurable electromagnetic fields outside the body.
That's what hugging is all about.
Oh, yeah. Hugging was very big in the film, too. And so they showed, there's a group called HeartMath. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. I've been aware of them, and I probably should interview somebody from there. And they have a guy who's their chief scientist. So one of the people that he interviews is the chief scientist at HeartMath. And they do this demo where they hook up two electrodes to yogurt. And then they show the director, Tom Shadyac, they show him very emotional images designed to, you know, to elicit huge emotion.
Right.
And you see the yogurt reacting. They've hooked up a microvolt meter or something like that to the...
He's sending signals into the yogurt from his body in some way.
Yeah, right. And they put in a little note, you know, this for the purposes of the film, this isn't the whole scientific protocol.
Right. Well, does the yogurt start crying or what? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So I wanted to share that because you said, you know, that emotional responses communicate to other people, and evidently not just to other people, but, you know, into the environment, to plants and to trees, etc. So go ahead. You were on a roll. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was talking about the communication part. The other interesting parallel, not clear what to make of it, is the fact that until recently, movies were generally about 90 minutes long.
Right.
Hour and a half. That was considered to be the standard length for a film. And it's interesting to note that the dream cycle in humans is about 90 minutes long.
Huh, I never thought of that. You're right, but I never made that connection.
Yeah, that ongoing cycle that actually runs 24 hours a day, but when the sun goes down, that cycle sends you off into sleep. In fact, that's one of the reasons, or one of the ways I got into this. I, you know, previously had done a lot of research involving rats and putting platinum, iridium electrodes into their little brains and stimulating them and reading EEGs from them. And I would inevitably see the rat sleep cycle, which of course is opposite from us since they get up at night and wander around at night and sleep most of the day. Because there was an interesting effect. Now, let me back up a little bit. I was trying to study dreams as the physiological substrate of dreaming. I didn't have a clue as to what it might be. But after I kind of gave up on electrical brain stimulation because the questions of how that behavior was motivated were so overwhelming, people started to shun that kind of study because nobody knew what the heck was going on that seemed to make electrical brain stimulation so rewarding. But in fact, all the measures of reward strength showed that it wasn't rewarding at all. So it was It was too confusing. I was looking around for something else to do, and I said, well, you know, one third of your life is spent sleeping, so maybe something important is going on there. Dreaming was an important part of what I was interested in. I also picked up incidental facts along the way, like, for example, LSD collects in the retina and in the pineal gland. And I thought, well, yeah, I can understand that retinal part, but what's it doing in the pineal gland? Well, as listeners probably know, the pineal gland is often thought to be the third eye, and indeed in reptiles and birds, it is very close to the surface, the underside of the skull, and it can be demonstrated that light actually penetrates the bird skull and directly affects the pineal gland.
And there's some speculation that it also that's true in our case, isn't there?
Well, not the skull penetration part. No. Ours is too far down. It's if you put your fingers in your ears and drew a line between them, and then did the same thing from the bridge of your nose to the back, it's practically in the very center of the mass of the brain.
Can I take my fingers out of my ears and nose now?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Exactly. And of course, that was very problematic in my research. One of the things I did was to ablate the pineal gland in rats, which means burn it out. And it also happens to, because it's a part of the endocrine system, it happens to be have a great vascular network around it for receiving and transporting chemicals. So that made it very problematic. Anyway, enough of that.
Well, this part of your journey is actually new to me, this the way that you moved away from the reward centers of the brain and
right.
Thinking about sleep and dreaming. I didn't know that piece of background.
Yeah, and I sort of kind of stumbled into it. I could easily see these states on the EEG records that were coming out of my machine. One of the first things I noticed was that when rats were falling asleep, they seemed to start off with a short dream. And that's contrary to what we were taught, was that humans, for example, start off by going into slow wave sleep. And then in the first cycle, it's like 80 minutes of slow wave. And then at the very end, 10 minutes of rapid eye movement sleep. And then a bit of awakening. Now, I point this out because a lot of people don't think they got a good night's sleep if they can remember waking up in the night. In fact, since I've been observing my own behavior in this regard for some time, what I notice is I wake up consciously between every 90-minute segment. And I actually look at the clock. They tell you you're not supposed to have a clock next to your bed. Well, I always look at the clock to see which cycle I'm in or going, what's the next one going to be. Generally speaking, in my experience, you need 5 of these hour and a half cycles per night, and that would be 7.5 hours of sleep. Now, sometimes I'll wake up after 4 of these cycles, and you know it'll be 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30, something like that, and I just don't feel like going back to sleep for the 5th one. But then I noticed during the day that that's somewhat detrimental to my, I just don't feel like I'm as sharp as I
right,
would have been.
Right.
And of course, we also know that lack of or deprivation of rapid eye movement sleep has some bad consequences. It leads to hallucinations. And they used to say that it would kill you if you eventually, but I couldn't find any evidence that people died from lack of sleep. It may be true. So these were the kind of interests I had, and I thought, well, filmmaking is a kind of a short circuit way to see if you can manipulate people's brains using this illusion, which we know isn't anything but a flickering light on the screen.
Let me take you back before you go on, because you started to say something about the pineal gland and that LSD accumulated there and that
yeah.
light got through birds' skulls.
Yeah.
I wonder if you completed that thread or not.
Well, not really. There's tons more to be said, but I did want to mention, check my notes here, the interview you did with Ruben Neyman,
yes,
number 256.
Yeah.
That was really exciting to me because he and I were on the same page with respect to things like melatonin and the pineal gland. And he pointed out that in humans, and I didn't know this until I heard him say this, there's a special circuit for blue light. And apparently that special circuit serves the same function as the proximity to the skull serves in birds. In other words, that blue light sensitivity, and it has its own circuitry from the eye into the brain, serves a similar function in terms of keeping us in synchrony with the environment.
You know, and he mentioned in response to, I think, a question that I asked about, you know, well, could you get some kind of special light?
Yeah.
Because I think he said the blue light was of the computer screen might keep one awake.
Yes,
and
exactly.
So I meant to go out and investigate the light that he said you could purchase. Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't do it. Did you?
I did. It's called No Blue. And I don't know if you can buy them at your local shop, but they're online.
Yeah.
It's just No Blue is the thing to Google.
Have you experimented with that yourself? And
no, okay. I haven't done anything in that regard. I'm getting a glass of water here.
I'm glad you told us that's what it is. It could be mistaken.
Okay, all right. That's later. Anyway, so that was one source of connection there. And I wanted to, before I actually get started here, I wanted to say a couple of things about sleep in general. I noticed that the Huffington Post, which is, everybody knows, a very popular site for news and articles of all kinds, over the past 3 or 4 months, they've really been honking on the benefits of sleep and how important sleep is and how you can get to sleep better, how you can stay asleep, and so on and so forth. Because I think it's already been demonstrated that most of us are sleep deprived. And in my own life, I began to see a great correlation between sleep deprivation and not only mental alertness, but general health. And we all know that when we get sick, one of the first things we do is we start sleeping a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a direct connection between sleep and the immune system and dreams and the health of the mental condition of the person.
I certainly concur with that. And probably some of us are more sensitive in that way than others, because I know that in college where, you know, most of the people I knew would pull all-nighters to cram.
Yeah.
I quickly learned that I couldn't do that. That if I pulled an all-nighter, I was guaranteed that I would get sick. I would get a cold.
Yeah,
it would just
exactly
affect my immune system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like guaranteed, like you said. I've discovered that for sure. And I've also seen that we are fools when it comes to regulating our sleep. You know, when I was a kid, my mother always made us go to bed at a certain time. Now, in the summer, it was still light out.
Right.
And we were constantly complaining, we can't go to sleep when it's still. Well, there's something to be said about that, too, because it is, light does have a big effect on whether you can sleep properly or not. But
I have to insert my own little anecdote here, because I remember that, you know, I grew up in kind of a ghetto area, and so the sort of non-middle class parents didn't care how late their kids stayed up. And so I would have to go to bed, and I could hear kids outside running around and playing and laughing. Why can't I do that?
Yeah, it was torture. I'd say exact same thing. I remember looking out at the window and seeing other kids playing in the twilight, having a lot of fun running around and stuff. We had to go. But at any rate, as usual, my mother was right. Another thing I've learned is that a standard bedtime is very important.
Mm-hmm.
The way it works out for me, 10:30 is bedtime.
Yep.
Because that works out to be with 5 full cycles to get me to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, which this is about exactly right.
Yeah.
So, and before I leave that topic, the fifth cycle is the feature film. because each of these cycles has more REM sleep and less slow wave sleep, by the time you get to the last one, it's almost all dreaming. Now, a lot of people say, oh, I don't dream, or I don't remember my dreams, or, you know, some people swear they don't dream at all. But of course, that's not true. We all do dream. There's been some question about whether rapid eye movement is actually a good measurement of dreaming, and I think it's probably the best one we have. Amazingly, that wasn't even discovered until the 60s, when a graduate student who was studying sleep happened to be watching his little baby and noticed that his eyes were flipping around.
Yeah. Something that human beings had observed since time immemorial. But
yeah,
never,
I know.
Never just connected that.
Apparently not. At any rate, so I was interested in trying to control dreams. Is there some way we could get our hands on dreaming, and that's what led to studying, trying to find a drug that interfered with dreams? That enhanced dreams, because all drugs seem to interfere with dreams. Including sleeping pills, by the way, and I think people should be aware that in general, the sleep they get under the influence of most sleeping medications is mostly slow-wave sleep. It actually depresses REM sleep, and that's why you feel kind of groggy or weird when you wake up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true, healthy sleep, which I think has to include dreaming. Okay, so I was looking around. How do I get my hands on dreaming? How could I push it around and do what scientists do, form a hypothesis and then do an experiment? And the whole thing with the pineal gland didn't work out because of the physical limitations. But I didn't lose my interest in sleep. I continued to play around with various techniques. And it was mostly just observation. And I also wanted to mention that observation is the main duty of the scientist. Experimentation is what comes later, but it's observation that is really key to trying to understand, or at least to formulate questions. And often I think that's forgotten in today's scientific world, that we need to look at something. We might not want to call it reality anymore, but we have to be observers. So I was observing, and one of the things I noticed was that when you close your eyes, you generally stop paying attention to the input that's coming into your brain from your eyeballs. I should also point out that the retina is actually part of the brain. If you look at how it develops, these stalks come out from the brain, and then the eyes develop on the ends of them. And so it's actually a little piece of the brain that's extended out there with an optical system on it to enable us to get these photons. And the rods and the cones are incredibly sensitive. The rods can respond to as little as one photon, which is totally amazing.
Yeah.
At any rate, so there you are with your eyes closed, you're fully alert, and you're paying attention. Now, once again, your guest, Dr. Naaman, had an interesting take on that. As I recall, his position was that you are actually conscious, unconscious, and asleep all at the same time, to varying degrees. And while you're awake and conscious, you might start daydreaming. So you might have a little dreaming coming into that. You might, if you're sitting in a boring lecture, you might also start to fall asleep. So you might have a little sleep come into that. And I liked his conceptualization of attention is basically a spotlight that can shine on any of these three areas.
Mm-hmm.
And during our waking day, we hopefully spend most of the time with our attention spotlight on our conscious input from our conscious brains. I have to go back a little bit and mention your heart brain, because I'm a big believer in that theory as well. I think we actually have five brains. I don't want to call them brains because that implies that they're in the cranium, but three of them are in the cranium, and neocortex and paleocortex, and then the brainstem area, a snake brain or whatever you want to call it. The other two are the nexus that you described around the heart, and then there's another one around the stomach. And the total number of neurons in those two systems, which are not in the skull, is greater than all the neurons in the spinal column, for example.
Hmm. Now, is that the solar plexus, that last one?
I don't know exactly. I think it's that as well as other nerves that extend beyond that. I don't know exactly the physical definition of it, but the reason I mention it is because we all know these things. I have a gut feeling, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. And also, I have a broken heart. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've ever had a broken heart, you know that your heart actually hurts. It physically hurts around your heart. It's not just some mental concept, boo-hoo, I lost my girlfriend or whatever. Mm-hmm. And also grieving and other things, I think, indicate that we are getting neuronal input from our stomachs and from our hearts into the system that includes the three parts that are in our skull. But I digress.
For the first time ever.
No, but I had to go back and pick that one up.
Yeah, and to just add to the digression, of course, I'm thinking a bit about chakras here. You know, maybe there are more than five.
Well, I think all these things are describing the same thing, mm-hmm. In different ways and right. with different points of view. But my main guy is Stuart Hameroff.
Right. You made us savvy to him in our last conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to mention him again because I've gone back now and I've tried to read and watch everything he's done. There's a lot of YouTube movies. If you go to quantumconsciousness.org, you'll see that he has a kind of a mishmash of references, all of which are clickable, and some of them are PowerPoint presentations that you have to download. Others are little YouTube videos that he's done. But he definitely builds up a more complete understanding than you or I are going to be able to relay here. So I really would recommend that listeners go to quantumconsciousness.org to hear Hameroff's complete story, because when he gives a talk, especially in the question and answer period, people really attack him for this point of view. And just to review very briefly, the point of view is that the cytoskeleton, which is comprised of microtubules inside of the neuron, are, according to his view, quantum computers that can communicate with each other through other than synaptic means, through these little gap areas, and therefore can operate as a quantum system that's all in coherence, and that's a particular word in the understanding. All this quantum stuff is the coherence idea and the collapse of this coherence. Because if you follow him all the way through, what you find is he's saying consciousness lives in the microtubules. It has basically two states. A wave state where is unknown. We get superimposition. Things can be in two places at once. We get entanglement. We get all those quantum effects until the actual moment of observation. Then the whole thing collapses, and it's reduced to a particle by the collapse. And his contention is that this change in state, which he calls ORC, by the way, a very unwieldy name, but orchestrated, let me get it right here, orchestrated objective reduction. In other words, the brain is orchestrating this. The objective part is the observer. And the reduction is in the coherence. So it builds and collapses a number of times per second. He relates this to the gamma waves that we've measured with EEGs. These generally run about 30 to 60 cycles per second, or hertz, as they call it. That corresponds with functional MRI studies, which show that certain areas of the brain are operating at these frequencies during certain experiences. Conscious attention, you'll get these gamma waves. So he contends that consciousness is not an analog feature of our existence that somehow emerges from having a bunch of neurons, but it's actually a pulsating buildup and collapse of quantum effects. And we are conscious at the peak of each of the, right before the collapse, or the collapse itself is the moment of consciousness. But we're only conscious one moment out of every second, or shall we say 60 moments out of every second. And that actually fits in with our personal experience to some extent. We know we have this critical flicker fusion rate, so we can measure that. We see that ours kind of fades away. I think it's about 15 and above, it becomes continuous to us. And we also learn from nature that if you study the prey-predator relationship, what you find is that the predator always has a faster rate than the prey. The predator can see faster than the prey. And that's what establishes that relationship. We also know from subjective experience that if we're in an accident or some really emotionally wrenching, time seems to slow down, right?
Yeah.
It seems to go into slow motion. You can see every frame. Okay, look, it's probably, I'm guessing, true that that gamma wave rate speeds up during those times. And then when we review it, it's just like speeding up the film in a camera. And then when you look at it at normal speed, it looks like slow motion. I think that explains, or at least points us in a direction there. It also has to do, I think, with aging. Because people say, well, the older you get, the faster time goes, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's because their consciousness rate is slowing down. I don't know if there's any evidence for that, but, you know, if your flicker rate is getting slower and slower, when you look at it normal, it looks like you're speeding up, doesn't it? That didn't work out the way I thought it would.
You know, the metaphor that I've always used is that it's like water draining from a bathtub. At first, when you pull the plug, you have to look very carefully, you know, is it draining or isn't it draining? Because it's not draining that fast. But as it gets down to the bottom, that whirlpool develops and it seems to spin faster and faster until it's gone. And,
yeah.
And that's, to me, is very much parallels my experience of the sense of time as we age. And that's certainly something that I've thought about. Another thing that what you've said has triggered for me, and by the way, kudos for being able to wrap your mind around all of that complexity that you just took us through and being able to summarize it as succinctly as you did.
Color. Well, I left out most of it.
Well, color me impressed.
I'll tell you, Hameroff, if you study him, it's all there. I mean, I even printed out one of these 50-page articles of his, and the man is brilliant, and he's put it all together and based his work on the work of Roger Penrose. I wanted to mention that last time we spoke, his name came up, and I said, oh, yeah, I know who he is. Well, I didn't know who he is. I had some other guy in mind. And Roger Penrose wrote the seminal The Emperor's New Mind book, and that got Hameroff and Penrose consulting together on this whole thing. Uh-huh. But now...
Wait, before you go on.
Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to observe that I've always felt kind of dismissive of New Age types who talk about raising their vibration rate, you know, that as you become more and more enlightened or clear or whatever, you're raising your vibration rate. But in a sense, it sounds like you said something that sounds sort of like it's going in that direction.
I think, in fact, it's already been demonstrated. I'm not positive this, but I know that they've done this, functional MRIs on advanced meditators. And they have found changes. Now, I'm not sure whether they found that the gamma wave rate increases in those people, but I'm guessing that's what they found. I'd have to go back and double check that. But
yeah.
It does seem that, yes, you could train yourself to do this, and perhaps that's what leads to enlightenment. Or at least it leads to more conscious nanoseconds per second. Now, he also points out that other organisms have the same objective reduction, and so it would appear that they have consciousness at a certain rate. And when you get way down there, the rate is really slow. In fact, he says, even an electron will spontaneously go through this change of state without an observer, but it's only once every few million years. So it might be said that even a simple electron has that one brief flash of consciousness every couple of million years. That's pretty slow, but it also might lead us to comprehend that other objects, not necessarily animate objects, have a similar collapse rate, which might be once a month for a tree, or maybe even more often for a tree, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that this concept that the whole universe is made of consciousness at all levels. So that, yes, indeed, a mountain has a kind of consciousness, and so does a rock, and so does a bug, or a dog, or a human. It's just a function of how often they have them.
Yeah, I should mention that Hameroff organizes a international conference on consciousness that I looked into and was thinking maybe of going, thinking, well, maybe I could get some good interviews. Maybe I might not be able to understand at least some of the people and what they're saying. It's in Stockholm, and I've forgotten what month it.
Yeah, it's coming up in May, I think, or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. And I was going to pursue it, and then somebody made the casual remark to me that Stockholm is very expensive, and that sort of caused me to
reject the idea. My take is that these days transporting my body to a place to get information is not a very efficient way to do it. I'll just wait until it's over and watch the YouTube movies. I won't be able to participate, but that's okay.
Yeah. Now, let me just, I want to be mindful of the time.
Yes, me too, because I got to get in my shtick here.
Well, okay, and I want you to get in your shtick, but I'm wondering if we're going to need yet another session, because where I thought we were going to go was a lot into your own inner experiences.
And that's my shtick. Yeah, that's what I want to get to.
And
we've still got time, Dave. We've still got time.
Really? You don't think it deserves a whole session of its own?
No.
Okay, go.
Okay. Now, here's the thing. I want to start off with a statement that I am not a psychologist or a medical doctor. I am not making any recommendations that people do this for anything other than fun.
You're just an actor who plays.
Psychologist. Some might think, and if you pursue this on the Google, you'll find that there are all kinds of people that I didn't know about who are proposing that you use the techniques that I'm about to discuss to fix yourself, to make yourself happier, to achieve new levels of motivation, and so on and so forth. And most of these people want to sell you something. They want to sell you a course or some DVDs or CDs and so on. A couple of people have built careers behind this phenomenon, but it's free and it's available to everybody. So I'm going to blurt out how to do it, and then you can try it out yourself. Now, I also want to mention before I blurt it out that one friend that I explained all this to said she was anxious to try it, and she did try it, and it frightened her. I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, I started into a dream state of some kind, and I became possessed of a fear that I would not be able to come back. It was just overwhelming, so powerful that it frightened me, and I immediately opened my eyes and said, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Right.
So, and I've had a couple of scary experiences, too, that I hope I can get to. But basically, here's the deal. When you are not pressed for time, and when you are not overwhelmingly tired, try sitting in a comfortable chair or recliner with the lights out, paying attention to what's coming into your eyes when your eyelids are closed. Some people say, well, yeah, I did that. I looked and I didn't see anything.
Right.
It was just black. It was all black in there. And I said, well, yeah, that's the way it starts out. Just keep looking. And that's the hard part. Once you have learned to focus your attention on this, it turns out to be pretty easy. But trying to stay focused with your eyes closed and your monkey brain is going off in all directions is very difficult. So you got to just sit there and you just got to wait. Now, what happens to me, and that's all I can talk about, is I start to notice that this black cave, it's not really black. It's kind of swirling around. It's got some, it's got some phosphenes in it. And that's a name that's been applied to the light that you see when you have your eyes closed.
I sometimes see like paisley type patterns.
Yeah, exactly. Paisley. Sometimes you'll see a little bright spot. Sometimes it's a swirling of kind of iridescence in a way. It seems to have some depth, but there's no depth cues, so you can't tell for sure. Okay, so now let's say you've moved on to the stage where you're now seeing some swirling. This part is just like staring at the clouds. If as a kid, maybe you laid on your back and looked at the clouds and you could see a dog and you could see a horse and a face or whatever. Well, the same thing. You're staring into the swirling void and you start to see things that look like things. Well, attend to those things and try to force them to become what they look like. Well, if you're successful, you will actually see a face. And if it's a particular person that you were thinking out about, you'll see that person's face. Now, the weird thing is they might not be looking at you. They might be looking off in the distance somewhere else. You might be seeing them from an angle above them, looking down, or down low. And if you're relaxed enough, I think, is important. And if you're also paying close attention, you can start to make those, what shall we call them, imaginary figures talk and act. You can get them to take off on their own so that you're not telling them what to say or what to do. They might just, I remember one in particular, I had an experience where I was, when I fastened in on it, it was a scene with three people in it. And I was up about 10 feet above them looking down, and they were talking, and I could overhear their conversation. They were talking about stuff that didn't interest me.
Wow.
And I was going like, well, this is boring. So I guess it's because I'm a director. I said, okay, cut. And then I said, look, guys, start talking about something like this. And just like actors, they said, oh, okay. And then I shut up, and they took off again. And it was much more interesting this time. I've also been very successful at calling up deceased friends and relatives. Now, this sounds a little screwy, but you're sitting in there looking into the cave. You see a face. Oh, it looks something like your mother. Okay. Hey, Mom. And then suddenly it shapes up, and it is. It's your mother. And she's there, and she might be talking to you or talking to somebody else, not saying anything. Sometimes an image will swirl and disappear. Sometimes they burst into a crystal clarity that is almost scary. It's like you're actually seeing them. It doesn't look like a dream state. You know, it's not fuzzy. It's sharp and detailed. And this brings me to another little sidetrack here. We all know something called our mind's eye. You know, when they say, well, picture it in your mind's eye. And you may close your eyes and then you may see a car or whatever you're trying to predict. Sometimes when I'm looking into the cave, into the swirling cave, an entire scene will pop into existence. I think these are two separate phenomena. I think the entire scene is coming from my mind's eye, and I think the swirling images are coming from my retina. The neural circuitry that gets the photon into your eye and then all the way through the optic nerve and so on, all to the back of the brain where the visual cortex is located, it actually branches out in a lot of different directions, and it goes at different speeds. And Hameroff talks about this quite a bit. For example, movement, even at the corner of your eye, will instantly trigger a reflex, and it seems instantaneous, whereas comprehension of a face might take a few milliseconds longer. So there's different brain areas that are feeding into the system, and I figure if the system is closed down and is not getting any input, what's to keep some of those other areas from feeding into the system as well? So I think there's two separate movie screens up there. One is your retina, and the other one is your mind's eye. Now,
so it's the mind's eye that's seeing these movies then?
No, I think they're separate. The mind's eye will show you a movie. In fact, what happens to me is if I'm looking into the void and I suddenly get a whole entire composed scene, I've learned to stop and look at that scene in great detail because I'm totally flabbergasted. It's complete. The other day I was looking for my swirling images, and a scene popped in. It was under a giant oak tree, and a little girl was playing on a blanket that had been spread on the ground. And the design on the blanket, little checks with little embroidery, it was so complete. Every blade of grass was represented. It wasn't something that came out of the swirl.
Now, to me, this is astounding. Now, would the scene, is that what you're calling the mind's eye? And the swirling,
yeah.
The swirling is the retinal. I get that.
Right, right.
Okay.
So, now, the swirling, you were going to ask a question?
Well, I guess I'm wondering what value or application. I might be getting too far ahead, but I'm just wondering.
Well, here's another thing. When you first look into the void, and you might want to write down these experiences so you can keep track over time, it's not always the same. It's quite different, for example, if you've had a couple of drinks. When you close your eyes, you'll start seeing fireworks, mostly in black and white, if my experience is anything. And I mean, just slashing, going every which direction, fireworks, boom, 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 boom. Much more difficult to get a fix on any kind of imaginary image that you might want to see. Recently, I was ill. I had a kind of a flu-like symptom, didn't we all?
Yeah.
And I was running a fever. And that was the first time I'd ever tried exploring while I had a fever. And I was astounded to see, I mean, this sounds too weird to be believed, but there was a little square box right in the middle of my cave. It's, you know, suspended there in space. Very well defined, and it kind of looked like the shrink wrap logo, actually. No, it didn't.
But of course, it's at the bottom of it all.
It had squares within the square, and they were different colors, so in that regard, it was somewhat similar. But it didn't change. There was no swirling. It was just like there, and I thought, oh, okay, well, that's not too exciting. So I went back to do something else. Hours later, I went back and looked again, and it was the same box. And I thought, well, God, this is a little sign that comes up to show me when I'm sick. Also, I now believe that if we could externally tap into this retinal show, it would tell us more than we could even imagine about our current homeostatic state. if you're agitated when you look into the void, you're going to see agitated patterns. That's pretty straightforward. But the density, the speed, all of these things, I'm convinced, are a reflection of your current state with respect to REM sleep, with respect to your immune system, and who knows, you know, your unconscious. Now,
yeah, I have to think that the pictures that you're seeing are somehow, you know, either they are pictures of other entities. Some people would go that direction and say, oh, well, you think it's all internal, but really it's another layer of reality. These beings exist in some other plane.
So I hadn't thought of that.
So yeah. It's either that, you know, and then you'd be off into the direction of maybe spiritism or, you know, some other direction. Or it's reflective stuff of your unconscious, your deep unconscious. And,
yeah.
And so then that raises issues of, well, from a psychotherapeutic view, what might you learn about yourself that would be useful? Or from an artistic point of view, how could you transmute this, bring it out to turn it into art?
Exactly. In fact, some of these things look like artworks when you're looking at them. I had one which I have to relate. I was looking into the void, and suddenly there was an infinite plane in the void. And it seemed to have a grid on it, so I could tell that it was actually diminishing in infinity. And I was below the plane. I was kind of like holding onto the edge of the plane with my hands. And then I thought, well, I have to get up here. So I climbed up on the plane. And then I noticed for the first time that there was a cross, a giant cross near me on the plane, and that Jesus was hanging on the cross. And somehow I knew that my job was to go up the little ladder and get his body and bring it down. And I thought, oh God, and nobody else was around, and yet somehow I knew that I had to climb up there. So I did. I tried to take his body down, and it, not to get too graphic, but it fell apart. And that was the whole experience.
It's interesting, the detail, and that it's not just an image, but it's a whole scene involving actions over time.
Yeah, because in this last 90-minute feature film, you get an entire movie to create. Now, if you're just sitting there awake and looking intentionally into this area, I think you're viewing the same area that dreams come from.
Okay.
Who knows if that's correct? But the unconscious is just bubbling up there, believe me. And maybe it's happening at a quantum level. See, that's the one thing I haven't done. I haven't made a natural progression from Hameroff's work and the where, you know, what is the conscious and what is the unconscious to this stuff I'm talking about now, looking around inside of your the back of your eyelids. But I want to tell a few more anecdotes about the state. I find it to be a huge amount of fun. In fact, I looked it up. Wikipedia, of course, has the answer to everything. This is also called the prisoner's cinema. Now, what does that tell you? Well, if you're a prisoner, you got nothing but time on your hands. You're sitting there with your eyes closed. Now you can watch your own movies. And this is true of all of us. We don't have to be prisoners. It's just that most of us don't have much time. But at any rate, dreams and waking life. Okay, just recently, I was working on a big video project, and I couldn't find a particular piece of tape. I had about 20 different hour-long tapes that it could have been on. So I thought, oh, I just have to get systematic. And I started making a list, and I started going through all the tapes. I went through every single tape, and I couldn't find it. Now, I didn't look at every minute of every tape. The segment I was looking for was about 20 minutes long, so I was kind of jumping through the tapes. And then I thought, you know, I could have missed it. It could have been on there. Maybe I jumped 25 minutes and I missed it. So I was very disgruntled, and I went to sleep that night. I had spent 5 or 6 hours working on this. And during the last dream in the morning, the answer came to me. The answer was, you're way too close to this. You're looking at the same tapes over and over again. Back off. Take a look from the other side of the room. What do you see? Oh, you see other tapes that you're not even looking in. The tape you're looking for is in those other tapes. As soon as I woke up, I got up and I put that into action and I said, oh, I bet you I must have accidentally put it back in with the unused tapes. The second tape I looked at, yeah. there it was.
Wow. You know, Jerry, I think we're running long. Yes, and I do think that there's more, much more for us to talk about around this. So let's leave people hanging here. Let's have this be a cliffhanger. We'll come back and we'll talk more.
You're the boss, Dave.
Okay, yeah, I like that. Okay.
Or shall I say, Dr. Dave, remember, it's all in your mind.
Well, you've just given us a great illustration of that. So thanks, Jerry. And, I'll probably squeeze in another two or three episodes between this and the next time we do it, but we will do it.
Okay, Dave, thanks.
Thank you. Well, we always seem to run long when I have Jerry on the show, and of course that's because of the comfort and energy between us, so I better keep this part really short. I'm impressed by the hypnagogic states Jerry has been achieving. I'm a bit jealous, actually. He seems to be able to enter these with great ease. I know that I fall into the camp he mentioned that gives up too easily. I'm looking forward to hearing more from him about these experiences down the road. And if you're interested in hearing more, too, let me know so that I know that we do have audience interest.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Okay, I need to keep these announcements really short today. First of all, let me call attention to my latest interview at wisecounselpodcast.com with Alastair McCarg on his memoir of bipolar mania. It's called Invisible Driving. I think his book is a bit of a literary masterpiece, inasmuch as it captures so well the energy and excitement of a major manic attack before the big crash of depression. His stream of consciousness style recreates his very wild ride and sweeps you up into it. Do use the discount codes on our site to save money and help support the show. You'll find the links to the discounts on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Look for the links to ShoeBuy.com, ForInkJets.com, and AngiesList.com. Angie's List is strictly for those of you who live in the U.S., unfortunately. You know how useful and valuable the user ratings of others are on such sites as Amazon.com and Apple's App Store and other websites where users rate products. I know those always provide me with a certain amount of guidance. Well, Angie's List takes the idea and applies it to a wide variety of services offered in your area in the U.S. So whether you need a dentist or a plumber or a masseuse or a contractor, you should check Angie's List for any recommendations or ratings they might have, and you'll save 25% with the discount code SHRINK. Your use of these discounts does help, but in truth it provides Shrink Wrap Radio with only a trickle of income. That's why your donations are particularly important as well, and I know there's so many important causes for you to donate to these days, but if you're so moved, just look for the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, this is psychotherapist, consultant, and author Dr. Sage Breslin, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Sage Breslin, who will be my guest on our next episode. Because I've run so long, I'm just going to read one letter from our email bag, and it goes, Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Marina Shapira, and I'm from Israel. I already wrote to you once, and you even read my email on the show, which was very moving. I hope you're in good health and everything is going all right. Thank you, and it is. Recently, I've listened to the interview you did with Varda Ratziel-Jaconte, an Israeli psychologist that you did in 2008. I think that your questions were great, but Varda's answers weren't informative nor accurate. She's not doing any research or private practice, and she failed to portray the complex reality we live in here in Israel. I live in Beersheba, which is the third largest city in Israel. About 2 weeks ago, the Palestinians launched two rockets at Beersheba from the Gaza Strip. On the same day, a bomb went off in a very central place in Jerusalem, where my family lives. My little brother of 15 years was there a few minutes after and saw badly wounded people. Yesterday, they launched a rocket at a school bus. Meanwhile, you have to go on with your life, knowing in the back of your mind that the siren can start and that you will have 60 seconds to hide. My boyfriend and I have our war drill, sleeping with decent pajamas, because in the middle of the night, you can find yourself racing down the staircase with the other neighbors, a flashlight and the cell phones on the bedside table, and the keys always at the door. And still, Israel doesn't look like a war zone. It's like having a double life. You go to work, to the university, go out with friends like any other student in the world. There are places in Israel, not the settlements, that are bombarded every day for the last 7 years, like the city of, and I don't know how to pronounce this, Sderot, I'll say. I think Israel is the only country in which you can be hiding from bombs at one moment and in the other be on your way to shop at H&M. And this is not to say that the other side is not hurting as well. This is not about politics, just about describing our life. One of my university professors, my major is psychology, who also teaches at Yale, has done some fascinating research on children and youth in Sderot. One of his main interests is personality and its interactions with stress. He always says that one of the advantages of living here is the lab from the dreams that the reality provides. I guess she means the lab of our dreams that reality provides. He's doing really one-of-a-kind research, which is also practical and integrative, and he has a private practice. He is also a very talented speaker, in English too, of course, and I think that he will be a great addition to your collection of interviews from the Middle East. I haven't exposed his name because I wanted to know first whether you will be interested in interviewing him. If you would, I will ask his permission to give you his email. I really hope that you are willing to do a show of a different perspective of the situation in Israel and explore more deeply the psychological coping people develop. Thanks again for your great shows. I continue to enjoy them as always, sincerely, and that's from Marina Shapira. Marina, thanks for being a listener and for taking time to write and for your excellent guest recommendation, which I hope to follow up on if you will send me his name and email address. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype or on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my longtime friend Jerry Trumbull for his part in today's episode. I hope you had as much fun listening as we did in creating it. I love my friend Jerry, and I hope that comes through as well. On the next episode, my guest will be Dr. Sage Breslin, who will be discussing the way she incorporates intuition into her work with patients suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.